This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. Today, supermarket giant Coles says it's going to put a five-year pause on its plans to phase out caged eggs as a result of the bird flu outbreaks. We'll get to that shortly. And also, the Borrello Group is going to stop service-killing sheep later this month at its Gingin Meatworks, 80 kilometres north of Perth. And we'll find out what that means for the producers who were relying on that service. 12:06 here on the Country Hour on the ABC right across Western Australia, streaming live on the web and on the ABC Listen app. The Western Australian government has just announced plans to create a new marine park that spans the whole of the Exmouth Gulf, about 1,200 kilometres north of Perth. Premier Roger Cook made the announcement less than an hour ago in Exmouth.
Exmouth Gulf is home to one of the most extraordinary and unique marine ecosystems on the planet, and it deserves the very highest level of protection. That's why today I'm proud to announce that my government will establish a whole of Gulf marine park to protect this globally significant marine habitat for generations to come. This marine park will be jointly managed with the Nurrindar Tanandi Guru Aboriginal Corporation to protect its cultural and environmental values while supporting the Gulf's ongoing social and economic use. It is proposed that at least 30% of the marine park will be designated as a no-fish sanctuary zone, which will provide the highest level of protection for the most ecologically sensitive areas of the Gulf. And this is an important part of it. These sanctuaries are important for continuing to make sure that we can restore and protect fish stocks and ensure that the Gulf is available for generations in the future. A carefully zoned and properly managed marine park will enable us to achieve strong environmental, social and economic outcomes and for the long-term benefit of Exmouth locals, but of course for all Western Australians. Importantly, our commitment will deliver on a key recommendation from the Exmouth Gulf Task Force final report. Now, this report is the guide that we'll be using as we now go about the preparations for planning and implementing the marine park with the traditional owners.
Premier Roger Cook announcing there will be some no-catch sanctuary zones to protect 30% of the Exmouth Gulf. Environment Minister Matthew Swinburne says this is part of their plan to protect a globally significant marine habitat from a changing climate.
As you can see behind me, every now and again you'll see a little humpback or a rather large humpback whale breaching or splashing out in the ocean. This is a really important habitat for humpback whales on their summer sojourn up the coast. There's also some really important species in the Gulf, including four different types of turtle that nest here. There is the dugongs, particularly on the east side of the coast. There's also a number of sea snakes, which some people might be a little bit more hesitant about, but which also deserve their protection. This is a really important site here. It is under pressure. There has been a marine heatwave event that started at the end of last year and continued into this year, and we have seen coral bleaching on the Ningaloo Reef, which just sits on the outside of the Cape. So one of the things that we're doing today that we're announcing is an additional $5 million for our Healthy Oceans program to go and support additional research on how we can make our coral reefs more resilient, how we can hopefully help those reefs recover from this marine heatwave. This is in addition to the $5 million election commitment that we made for the Healthy Oceans program. It's for the seagrass program that we have been supporting, particularly down in Shark Bay. So this will make $10 million that this government has committed to the Healthy Oceans program to help us to deal with the impacts of climate change on our ocean environments. And I think this is really critical. We're at a critical juncture. We're protecting the Gulf, And what we plan to also do is provide additional money for research to allow our scientists to come forth and come up with the ideas and the techniques that can help us to see our coral recover. So this is really exciting.
State Environment Minister Matthew Swinburne speaking to the media a short while ago in Exmouth. 10 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Melissa Haslam is the CEO of WAFIC, that is the WA Fishing Industry Council. Melissa, what's your reaction to this new Exmouth Gulf Marine Park?
Well, it's not a shock to us. We've been having discussions about the Exmouth Marine Park for many years, and commercial fishers have been advised throughout this process, so it's not a shock in that respect. And the bottom line is Exmouth is a beautiful spot. There's no sustainability concerns there whatsoever, but there's also been commercial fishing there for over 60 years. The biggest fisheries there are MSC certified, which proves their sustainability, but not that they need it. I mean, look, the proof is in the pudding. We've been commercially fishing there for so many years, and the fact the Gulf is so pristine and worthy of marine park status, I think just demonstrates how responsible commercial fishing is.
What sort of commercial fishing activity occurs in this region, in this Gulf?
Oh, well, there's the highly valued Exmouth prawn. That would be one of the biggest fisheries up there. But there's also a little bit of mullet fishing, a bit of whiting. There's some coral and marine aquarium fishing. And there's also some pearling that happens up in the Exmouth Gulf.
So what impact will the 30% no-catch zone have on those fishing enterprises?
Yeah, it's a lot. 30% is a lot. And the devil is always in the detail, right? So it does depend where those sanctuary zones go, because they're total lockout of commercial fishing. So the devil is in the detail, but successive environment ministers and the current Minister for Fisheries have assured us that there will be no impact to commercial fishing. So that's the promise. That's certainly the expectation. And we will now be working closely with government to see that that is delivered.
Okay. So does the industry have a place at the table in negotiating those specific no-catch zones?
Yes, that's right. We will be consulted. And the fact that we have been promised our fishery won't be impacted is very heartening. But like you said, the devil is in the detail. We need to see exactly where they're going to be. And 30% is quite a large chunk, but you would assume the high value sanctuary zones will overlay breeding areas, nurseries, fish nurseries, seagrass areas. We shouldn't and wouldn't be commercial fishing there anyway.
The government is also investing a further $5 million to bolster the marine heatwave recovery efforts. Is that a welcome addition?
Oh, yeah. I mean, always. Unfortunately, it's one of those things. Marine parks themselves are not a silver bullet. They have a place. They have a role. But they don't help with things like heat waves. They don't help with oil spills or pollution, you know. So they're not the silver bullet. So if more research can go into the effects of climate change on our oceans or how we can better handle heat wave conditions, that's always going to be welcome.
How is the process of developing this marine park, the Exmouth Gulf Marine Park, differed to the South Coast Marine Park, which was pretty much controversial from the get-go?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, when marine parks are announced in sort of a knee-jerk reaction way, they are always chaotic and disastrous. Exmouth has been different in the respect that commercial fishers have been informed from the beginning. We've had a task force. We've had people at the table. There's been a build-up to this announcement so that the marine park itself has been reasonably well informed. That a marine park that's formed under those circumstances, we have no argument with that. It's when marine parks are just announced off the cuff, no consideration given to commercial fishing or the impacts to the supply of fresh fish to West Australians, that is where we do have a big problem. Hopefully, by the end of this process, we'll be able to look back and say Exmouth Marine Park was the shining example of how things should be done, because certainly the South Coast Marine Park was not.
So do you think the state government has learned from that process along the South Coast with that marine park and applied a different strategy to this one?
I hope so. I mean, the South Coast Marine Park was awful for everyone, and we are still dealing with the fallout of that. I mean, there are still fishers now going through compensation processes. It's caused a lot of stress, anxiety. And for all West Australians, our availability of fresh local seafood is once again taken a hit. And West Australians like to eat our own fish. Why do we want to rely on imports of fish from somewhere else when the best fish in the world is right here on our doorstep? And so long as it's managed sustainably, we should be able to enjoy that. And Exmouth hopefully will be an example of that sort of coexistence. You can have a marine park, you can have sanctuary zones, and you can still have your commercial fishing so people can still enjoy their seafood.
Melissa, great to get your thoughts this afternoon. Appreciate your time.
No worries. Thanks so much, Belinda.
That is Melissa Haslam, and Melissa is the CEO of WAFIC, the WA Fishing Industry Council, and responding to the announcement today from the state government, plans to create a new marine park that spans the whole of the Exmouth Gulf, which you'll find 1,200 kilometres north of Perth. 16 past 12.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
The Borello Group is going to stop service killing sheep later this month at its Gingin Meatworks, 80 kilometres north of Perth. Producers received a short email on Wednesday saying the last date for sheep service kills would be September 19th. Joe Prendergast has been following this story. Joe, do you know why Borello made this decision?
Belinda, Borello's have chosen not to speak with us, but I understand they have some significant expansion plans for the beef side of their business, and they've decided it's most efficient to focus on that rather than the sheep service kills. That's what I'm hearing. And when we say service kills, we're talking about an abattoir which slaughters and processes livestock on behalf of a farmer who then retains ownership of the meat. We've heard in conversations about other abattoirs in the past when they've been considering the future of service kills that it is an expensive exercise to do a line of, I don't know, four or five sheep in comparison to 100. So I imagine that cost structure and perhaps some of the legislation that you have to go through is no different for Borello's.
How many sheep producers does this affect?
Borello's noted in the email that they sent out that this is not a decision that we have made lightly, given how many of our customers will be affected. So there's a bit of a clue. I've spoken to a number of people who are using Borello's service for sheep kills, and they've all commented that this will impact a lot of people. Some of them were using them, you know, occasionally just to do a few sheep. Others were using them regularly to supply meat into Perth butcher shops, meat wholesalers or restaurants. And there's a lot of work that goes in to achieve that point where your meat is being in demand and sold on a weekly basis. So these people are looking at other processing options in the area. There is another small abattoir in Gingin called Bigfoot. They weren't answering the phone when I tried them. Or there's Avon Valley Meats, which is about 100 kilometres away at Northam. But some of the other really big concerns that people have is that Borello's may close their beef service kills, and that would have a massive impact on many businesses. And I have heard that it's really difficult already for small beef producers to get kill space. So you can understand that that is a genuine concern for some of these people that perhaps might have sheep or cattle that are using that small service kill at the moment. So they're really looking at their options.
Yeah, it really does sound like there's some real anxiety in the community of small batch meat suppliers.
And it follows on, doesn't it, from that conversation we were having late last year and into early this year when the Davenup Butchering Company said it was no longer providing custom kill services, and then a few months later it backflipped on that decision. So it is still providing the service, but that situation and the uncertainty created a lot of anxiety, and you can see that now in that north of Perth and around Gingin area. People I've spoken to impacted by Borello's shutting its sheep service kills say they need to find an alternative processor or they'll look to get rid of their sheep. They're really frustrated, though, that government, they feel, is not supporting producers who are selling their own meat and doing that work that I mentioned earlier. They feel that they're not really getting that support where they're working really hard to value add to the animal and stay in the industry. They just don't have the backing to ensure they can access that kill space. And you think, well, what are the alternatives? If you can't access a commercial kill space, can you set up your own? And the answer to that is it's really difficult. It's cost prohibitive and it's heavily regulated. So these people who have done this work over many years to really build up their brand, their name, feel backed in a corner in a sense and forced again to be a price taker.
You said a moment ago that Borrello's is going to focus on its beef processing. What are the plans?
Well, I'm hearing that they're upgrading their beef processing to become a tier two exported accredited abattoir. And I just had a look through some of the documents with the Shire of Gingin, just trying to find out a bit more about that. And in late 2024, a major expansion of the abattoir was flagged in a presentation to the Shire of Gingin. And documents have been lodged for proposed upgrades of the main kill or processing floor, but I do suspect there might be further plans for beef processing in the pipeline. Some interesting numbers that I did find in that document for this initial upgrade. It said that last year, the Gingin Abattoir processed 14,200 hot carcass weight tonnes of beef, 1,300 tonnes of sheep, and 12 tonnes of goats. And that does exceed the facility's production capacity, which is acknowledged in the report. But it also goes on to say that the data only services to highlight the demand for the facility, which is one of only three remaining meat processing facilities that can be readily accessed and serviced in the metropolitan area.
So where to from here for sheep producers impacted by this decision from Borrello's to stop doing sheep service kills?
Yeah, I touched on earlier, they're trying to find kill space in other abattoirs, also trying to work out if they do that, how they would absorb the additional freight costs to get their sheep to another location. If they move out of that Gingin area, the meat then has to find its way to Perth. All of those logistical things I think the producers are trying to work out, trying to get some certainty about what the future looks like in other lines. And I imagine the butchers and the restaurants and the other buyers of that sheep meat that was going through Borrello as small kills will be watching this space as to what happens from here for their meat supply as well.
Thanks for those details, Jo.
No worries.
Jo Prendergast reporting on the news that the Borrello Group is going to stop service killing sheep later this month at its Gingin Meatworks, 80 kilometres north of Perth. 22 past 12, we'll get an update from the newsroom around about half past 12 and then check the weather conditions around Western Australia with a cross to the Bureau of Meteorology. First, supermarket giant Coles says it will put a five-year pause on its plans to phase out of caged eggs as a result of the bird flu outbreaks. The company says global and domestic production of eggs has been hit hard by avian influenza outbreaks, and it's made the decision to pause the transition of branded eggs while the industry recovers. Jane McNaughton has the details.
Major supermarkets Coles, Woolworths and Aldi have pledged to phase out or ban battery cages from their supply chains by this year, citing animal welfare concerns from consumers. But after 18 months of disrupted egg supply chains leaving supermarket shelves empty, prices up and purchasing limits on the popular protein, Coles has backflipped. Werribee egg producer Danielle Cucinotta says it was always going to come to this.
I'm not even shocked, to say the least. I feel like the major supermarkets have backflipped since, what, early 2017, 2018, when this disaster started. I think the major supermarkets, Coles specifically in this case, absolutely know that eggs, milk, bread, butter, so on, they're major commodity items. They need them in store for the average consumer to come in and purchase whatever else they need. So the moment you take away a major commodity item, eggs in this particular case, they actually end up losing out on their bottom line across their entire grocery basket.
Coles say that due to, and I quote, the significant impact of recent avian influenza outbreaks in Australia, and they've decided to pause the transition to cage-free for branded shell eggs. Do you think that this is purely because of avian influenza?
Oh, I mean, it's like, the part that gets me for these major supermarkets and Coles in this instance is the whole argument is animal welfare, right? So it's like you can't have your cake and eat it too in this scenario. You're either doing it for a particular reason, which personally we think is all absolute nonsense, right? We don't actually think it's a animal welfare debate. We think it's a profitability debate on their end and they want to control the market. However, they argue that it's animal welfare friendly, get rid of cages. Sure, you guys do as you please. And then they backflip time and time again because it is a profitability argument. Because if they say that they care about animal welfare, then they would say to themselves, yep, we're going to phase it out, but they don't. Cages are animal welfare friendly. They're not for everyone. We understand from a consumer choice perspective, not everybody wants to buy them. But for goodness sake, we are living in a cost of living crisis. And they know if they remove the more affordable elements of eggs right now, that is actually more problematic to the bottom line of their dollars. And that's all they care about. And the fact that there's an avian influenza outbreak and there will be continual avian influenza outbreaks because we've been told the science is when, not if. It's just a constant battle with the major supermarkets on dictating how consumers get to purchase their products and what they get to purchase. And that's just bipolar behaviour constantly.
Considering that the caged egg industry, including yourself, have long been saying to the supermarkets and to governments that caged eggs are necessary for the reasons you've just outlined, do you feel a bit vindicated today?
Oh, it's like insane to us. Like as farmers, we are constantly pulled from one side to the next. And as a caged farmer, where my entire livelihood, our entire farm, our generations of change, all revolves around the way that we practice on farm and the way that we look after our hens is constantly being vindicated and told that we're not doing the right thing. And then for them to say, hey, actually, you know what? This doesn't work for us today. It's like, have you not been listening? Like, we are the people that do this 24 hours, 7 days a week, and we understand, again, I do not make or I don't produce eggs for every consumer, but for the consumers that I do have, they are cost conscious. They do want to know that we're looking after our birds. And for Coles in this instance, it's like I said, it's a profitability game, and I'm just absolutely sick and tired of the supermarkets getting to dictate what we can and can't do, and the government for that fact, because, I mean, surely you have better things to do than tell us whether or not we're looking after our birds in the way that Coles dictates. Remember that, because the supermarkets are dictating the way that consumers can and can't purchase their products.
You mentioned government there as well. State and federal governments have still got their pledge of removing caged eggs from the farming system by 2036. So when Coles is extending deadlines and there's still that looming decade of the governmental phase out, is that confusing as a producer?
Oh, it's actually just a little bit heartbreaking, because the truth is, I think from our perspective, we sit here and say, okay, fine, you want to phase us out, you want to ruin all of our farming and our history and our generations, fine, cool, I'll walk away, we'll work with that. But what I can't deal with is the constant pullback and change, and the fact that we already know the answer doesn't work. We see that across countries overseas. We see in New Zealand what that did to eggs availability and prices. We saw that in the UK, that all they ended up doing when they phased out cage systems was simply start importing and trucking eggs from other countries, such as Turkey and Israel at the time, into the UK. We already know the system doesn't work, and it's a bit rich from the government when you can afford, when you're getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars, which is not the average of the Aussie consumer purchasing caged eggs, that you constantly get to create this ideology that somehow this is better. We are in a cost of living crisis. People are struggling. We already see that from the food bank statistics of how many people still need access to food and the food insecure in their homes, on top of the fact that surely you have better things to do, like look after the crime rate instead of telling farmers how to farm.
She's not holding back, is she? Egg farmer Danielle Cucinotta speaking to Jane McNaughton. And in explaining the decision, the Coles spokesperson provided this statement. It says, due to the significant impact of recent avian influenza outbreaks in Australia, we've made the decision to pause the transition to cage-free for branded eggs. This step is necessary to help the industry recover and ultimately ensure a stable supply for our customers. It goes on to say, we take the welfare of animals very seriously and are committed to maintaining more than 85% cage-free branded eggs and achieving our exit of caged eggs in the long term. We've decided to extend the cage-free target deadline for branded eggs to 2030, which will still be ahead of the industry deadline of 2036. So a little bit of an explanation of Coles's decision to put that 5-year pause on its plans to phase out of caged eggs. This is the Country Hour, 12:30. Tony Carr is here with an update from the newsroom.
Good afternoon, Belinda. WA's Premier Roger Cook says a new marine park in the state's north will balance social, economic and environmental outcomes. The Exmouth Gulf Marine Park will encompass the entirety of the Gulf, 1,200 kilometres north of Perth. The region is considered a global hotspot for threatened sawfish and is home to one of WA's most productive prawn fisheries. The state government has labelled issues with its residential battery rebate scheme as teething problems. The comment comes amid reports installers are boycotting the scheme because they're owed tens of thousands of dollars. The scheme was launched in July and offers rebates and interest-free loans for eligible households. And the WA opposition says the government's silence on lead in drinking water at Perth Children's Hospital demonstrates a lack of honesty with the public. The Child and Adolescent Health Service has confirmed its water testing program, carried out between early 2023 and early 2024, identified 11 instances of lead that exceeded recommended guidelines. The service says remediation since that discovery has resulted in no further detections. Belinda, more news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you for that update, Tony. 29 to 1.
This week on Landline, a program looking at changes in rural and regional Australia and the struggle of country communities to survive. Landline, Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
In just a moment, you are going to find out how much rain and frost might be on the way over the weekend and early next week. And then you're going to hear about a photo of a giant anchor that's on a cattle property and clearly visible from the sky. Fremantle Dockers supporters believe it's a good luck sign for tomorrow night's AFL final against the Gold Coast Suns. And this anchor, it is on the world's largest pastoral property, which is in South Australia. And of course, Richard Hudson spent, well, most of the morning tracking down the manager of the property. So you'll hear from the manager shortly. Also, we will get a wrap of this week's wool sales just before the news at 1 o'clock. It's 3 weeks in a row now that the market has been on the up. Justin Haydock will go through all the details for you just before one. Right now, making our way to the Bureau of Meteorology, and Grace Abbott is with you. Grace, let's start in the Southwest Land Division. Here in the city, it's already grey and overcast and a little bit of rain about. Is that the story across most of this part of WA?
Yeah, indeed. Looking at the satellite at the moment, this cold front that reached the southwest of the Capes early this morning has pushed inland, and it's currently spanning from about Shark Bay all the way down to Albany. And like you said in the intro, I guess the summary for this is that today and tomorrow we're very much looking at the cold front, and then in the new week we've got frost inland. So that's the main story. But yes, this cold front is associated with a low-pressure system offshore to our west. Now, that front will continue to the east tomorrow as the low-pressure centre moves along the south coast. And this is going to bring some really windy conditions to those along the south. So from around about 2 p.m. today, we can expect a severe weather warning to be issued for those damaging wind gusts down about the south coastal districts. Now, showers and thunderstorms with this system have brought some pretty healthy falls before 9 a.m, which I think Richard will cover a bit later. But for the rest of today, locations southwest of about Durian Bay to Northcliffe can expect totals of around 20 to 30 millimetres by midnight, with a few isolated totals of 50 to 60 millimetres. Now, inland, the outlook hasn't changed, so we're still looking at 10 to 20 millimetres around the Franklin area and through to Geraldton, falling to 2 to 10 millimetres further inland for the rest of the Southwest Land Division, dropping to less than 2 about Esperance. Now, there is still the chance of some gusty and possibly damaging thunderstorms about the west today, and that'll extend along the south coast tomorrow. Some of those rainfall totals for tomorrow will ease off in inland parts, so about 0 to 2 millimetres at Wagen and Pingerley, increasing to 5 to 15 millimetres along the south. Then Sunday brings another front to the far southwest, maintaining that 2 to 10 millimetres for western districts, though less than 2 millimetres if you're in the Great Southern or the Wheat Belt. Now, a cold air mass is going to follow that front on Sunday, with some possible small hail over the south coastal districts on Sunday night into Monday morning. Now, on Monday morning, some clearer skies inland with a ridge moving in is going to allow some frost formation with those overnight minimums of 0 to 2 degrees in the Great Southern and the Wheat Belt area. And finally, Tuesday, seeing showers contract to the south coast as that ridge is dominating, again with possible frost more widespread this time, spanning across the inland southwest land division into parts of the Goldfields and the Gascoyne.
And Grace, what can you see for northern and eastern parts of WA?
Yeah, so it's remaining quite sunny up in the Kimberley, with the tail end of the front bringing some light showers to the western Pilbara and the Gascoyne today and tomorrow. On Monday and Tuesday, some eastern parts of the Kimberley can expect some isolated afternoon showers with the chance of a thunderstorm as well on Monday. And with this ridge developing in the south, we're going to see some southeasterly winds increase across northern parts from Monday as that ridge strengthens.
Thank you for that, Grace. It is 25 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Richard Hudson in the studio now to take a look at the rainfall figures.
Yeah, and up in the northern areas, no rain at all. Well, there was 1 mil in Carnarvon, but in the more towards the east, in the Goldfields, Norseman had a bit of a drop, 13 mils. And then in the Eucla, further east, there was 5 mils at Eucla itself. And then in the southwest land division, in the central west, Geraldton recorded 5, and there was nothing more. In the lower west, nowhere recorded more than 2 mils. In the southwest, there was a fair bit, so it'll be 20 and above. Baling up 25 mils, Beetle up 29, Boyne up north 21, Busselton 20, Cape Lewin 38, Carlotta 25, Chapman Hill 45, Quorum up 34, Darden up east 24, Doyle Road 21, Four Acres 25, Happy Valley Alert Station 21, Jarrowood 27, Carriedale 33, Manjimup up 24, Nanup 31, Paindale Alert Station 21, Pemberton 25, Quinnan up 29, Rosabrook 25, Scott River 27, Shannon 25, Warner Glen 28, Willyabrup 37, Windy Harbour 35, Yanmar 22 and Yungarelup recorded 24. In the southern coastal area, nothing over 2 mils, and in the central wheat belt and the Great Southern, there was no rain at all.
23 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Richard, how excited are you about the footy finals?
I'm very excited and a little bit nervous. And of course, as you mentioned, I've been trawling through all of the information that there is on the net about the big game tomorrow between Freo and the Gold Coast Suns. But on what I did find is on a Freo Dockers fans Facebook page, there's a photo taken from a plane above a remote station, and there is clearly a huge, huge white anchor in the shot. Now, the caption on this particular post reads, "My son is flying for Wright's Air at William Creek in South Australia. Like me, he is also a passionate docker. He spotted this anchor at Anna Creek Station. We think it's a sign from the footy gods." And underneath that particular caption, there's a whole heap of people commenting. They agree it's a good omen and blah, blah, blah. Now, Anna Creek happens to be the world's largest pastoral station. It's about 850 kilometres north of Adelaide. Matt Williams manages and lives at Anna Creek Station. Matt, what's the story behind this anchor?
It's about approximately 100 metres long, and it's situated between William Creek and the Anna Creek Painted Hills. It's roughly sort of halfway in between. And it's on a pretty big baldy clay pen, sort of probably 2 or 3 k's long on the edge of it. And yeah, like the long and short of it is the planes take about 35, 40 minutes to get down to the Painted Hills to show the tourists around down there. And, yeah, it just kills a bit of time and The reason we put in is just to give them something to talk about on the way down, really. Otherwise, it's sort of looking at a bit of desert country and not too much happening for them.
And what's it actually made out of? Is it stones or?
Yeah, so it's just on the baldy clay pan, like a hard clay pan with a heap of small pebbles on it. And I never even stepped it out or anything. I just sort of done it freehand. It turned out it actually come out perfect. So well, I was very surprised.
It looks absolutely magnificent. And being a fellow Dockers supporter, I'm very, very proud. People in Western Australia probably just assume that everyone in South Australia either barracks for the Adelaide Crows or Port Adelaide. What got you to be so passionate about the Fremantle Dockers, Matt?
Well, yeah, so the anchor symbolises the station brand.
It's got nothing to do with the Dockers, you mean?
No.
Oh.
It never did at the start, put it that way. So, when we moved to Anna Creek, it's got the anchor brand for the brand for the station. And since then, we're obviously, I do follow AFL a little bit. I wouldn't say I'm a passionate AFL follower, but especially come finals time, you sort of naturally, I probably do lean towards Adelaide Crows a little bit. But absolutely, because Fremantle, especially because they haven't won a grand final yet, and because they run the anchor is their logo. So, yeah, we've definitely got a soft spot for them, absolutely. Like, if, put it this way, if the Crows and Fremantle get to the grand final, I actually don't know who, I wouldn't be upset who won or lost because, it'd be good to see the underdogs come up anyway.
Oh, that's fantastic. Just out of interest, though, historically, I mean, you're about 850, 900 Ks north of Adelaide, 160-odd Ks east of Cooper Pedy. How on earth did an anchor symbol become your branding symbol? Or is that a bit of tongue-in-cheek from whoever settled there in the very, very early days?
I don't know. There were a couple of old blokes that would know the exact story, but I don't know, because that's right. The closest bit of water we got's Lake Eyre, and you definitely wouldn't have a ship out on that with an anchor. So I have no idea, but it's a very clear station brand, put it that way. It's pretty handy for that one.
Now, your station is huge. It's renowned as being the world's largest running cattle station. Is that still accurate?
We've split the leases a little bit with what it was, but it's still the largest pastoral lease as one lease as a station. Yeah, there is, yeah.
How big is it?
It's about 15,760-odd square K.
Wow, that is huge. A lot of people in Western Australia have heard a bit about the drought that parts of South Australia have been going through in the last year or two. You're in a part of the world that's used to not getting much rain. How's Anna Creek been going?
Average rainfall is only 100, and we're in the driest part of Australia, only 145 mil is the average, and we were okay up until sort of the last month or two, because we had a bit of summer rain, enough patchy summer rain to sort of pull us through. We definitely haven't been as dry as what they have down the south, bottom half of South Australia. But we're definitely feeling the pinch now. Like we rely a lot on dam water. We have got underground bore water, but it's very patchy. And, yeah, we rely a lot on dam water. And when the dams are going dry, unfortunately, cows need feed and water. Well, water first and then feed. And if you haven't got the water, you haven't got any animals. So we're sort of starting to narrow things up a little bit there now.
I know it's a long way away, but the south of Queensland was hit by some flooding earlier this year. That water has to run somewhere. Did any of it make its way towards your station or your family's other stations by any chance?
It did, except it stopped right on the edge of it on a pretty big salt lake, and it is absolutely useless for us. Only some benefit we get out of it is a natural fence line, because when all that fresh water out of the Diamantina and the Cooper and all that run in to Lake Eyre, within a week or two it turns proper salty. So the only things that will live in there is a few fish and pelicans and the odd seagull and whatnot that's got lost.
Well, I hope you get some real rain soon for your pastures and for your cattle. And more importantly, tomorrow night, Matt, make sure you're just barracking nice and loud for the Fremantle Dockers, being the number one Freo Dockers fan in all of South Australia.
Yeah. I definitely will turn it on and watch it because, yeah, we've got a few family over in Western Australia and that, and I want to see them come up, put it that way.
Good on you.
The underdogs, so.
And thanks for your time on the WA Country Hour too.
No worries, Richard. All good.
Matt Williams, who manages and runs the world's largest operating station, Anna Creek Station. It's in South Australia. And Matt was speaking to Richard Hudson. Anna Creek's, it's about 850 kilometres north of Adelaide or 160 kilometres east of Cooper Pedy. 1:45, and it's been a busy week at Daly Waters in the Northern Territory, with staff from Consolidated Pastoral Company gathering for CPC's annual Station Challenge. About 140 workers from CPC spent the week competing in a range of events, from beef jerky competitions to photography, barrel racing and maintenance relays. Lucy Gurner from Carlton Hill Station in WA's Kimberley won Best Jerky. She says it was a great win, especially considering she's fairly new to making jerky.
I've only made jerky a couple of times, but yeah, just bought a dehydrator and had a few goes, and yeah.
Right, so it's not like you've been at Carlton Hill for months, practicing every day, perfecting the recipe.
Yeah, I just had a couple of goes.
And it was beef jerky. Now, CPC is a big beef company. It was beef jerky. Were there other meats, though, in the competition?
Yeah, I think there was some camel. Yeah.
And did
but
you?
But mine was just beef.
And so do you think now when you go back to Carlton Hill, the pressure will be on for you to churn out this award-winning jerky on a weekly basis?
Yeah, I think they will be wanting me to make it.
Cunnanurra will find out about it and they'll be ringing up wanting bags as well.
Yes.
Now, just quickly, because I am a big fan of this topic, right? Are we talking long strips of jerky or small pieces?
Yeah, long strips. Actually, they're all pretty different, but yeah, mostly long strips.
Long strips. How chewy?
Yep.
How chewy are we talking?
Very, very chewy.
Lucy Gurner from Carlton Hill Station telling Matt Brann all about her now famous beef jerky. The other winners were Kelly Shotton from Bunda Station, who got the Innovation Award. She made her own boar running app. And Danny Peterson from Dungawan Station was the overall winner, the 2025 CPC Station Challenge. She's originally from Hervey Bay, no agricultural background, and apparently mum and dad were in town to cheer her on. 13-1. A Southwest recreational shooter has questioned a recent state government-run aerial program that saw more than 500 feral deer culled. The Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development ran the program in Hervey and Esperance over July and August. Damien Shaw, a recreational shooter from Hervey, says he found several deer with an average of 4 bullet wounds following the cull. For him, it's raised concerns the pest suffered as a result.
So I've only seen a couple of the deers, or I've only come across a couple of the deers up the bush while getting wooden bits pieces that have obviously been shot during this aerial program. I understand a helicopter is difficult to shoot from, but for an animal to have 5 or 6 bullets in it, multiple shots that are in the back of the leg, the neck, that to me doesn't sound like it's a clean kill. That sounds to me like that animal suffered. As recreational hunters, we're always very much under the spotlight from places like RSPCA and stuff like that, which is with good reason, that we do the right thing. We don't want to shoot an animal inhumanely or anything like that, but they've managed to run around and do this type of shooting, which some of those animals look like they've suffered, the ones that I've seen, but there's no ramifications for it because it's not been seen by the public I've found about four or five around the back of Harvey Dam and Yarloop and stuff. And the five deers that I've seen, each one's got an average of four bullets in it.
How do you shoot deer humanely?
At the end of the day, if you're shooting for a deer, it's got to be a headshot or a chest shot. That's the only thing that's going to bring it down. And it's going to need to be a decent sized caliber rifle as well. You can't tell me that they did that heart or the chest space shot first and then just shot it in the back for the sake of it. I would have thought that there would be a standard that if they're required to take a shot, you only take a shot that is going to be a humane kill for the animal. It's an awareness thing. I just want people to know that at the end of the day, the government's turning around and taking our firearms as recreational shooters, which I know there's a lot of recreational shooters out there who will feel the same as I do, and then made it that we'll get government contractors in because that's the better thing to do. But then the government contractors aren't doing any better job than us, if not worse. Seeing those animals with all those bullets in and stuff like that, it just really, for me, just sunk in that it's like, how is that allowed? If I'm not allowed to do that type of stuff, how are they allowed to go around and do that stuff and it not end up by the RSPCA for animal cruelty or anything like that? I just really, you know, didn't want it to just go unseen completely. What I would like would be a response from DPIRT in regards to what their standard is for shooting deer. If their standard is for shooting deer that it has to be a head or a chest shot, where's the explanation for the other ones? Don't just give a response that, oh, no, it's just that's how we, you know, that's how we do it sort of thing.
Harvey recreational shooter Damien Shaw speaking to Pip Waller. Sean Kilkenny is the leader of advocacy and team management at the Australian Deer Association. He also has some concerns with aerial culling.
Aerial culling does have its place. We wouldn't prefer it to be the first option. It's obviously incredibly expensive. There are concerns where sometimes they're relating to the humaneness of deer being shot, while deer being moving targets and also a moving helicopter, so that can also lead to, you know, unfortunate events. The other issue that is ongoing with aerial culling programs is they are effectively shoot-to-rot programs. So if a wild animal is shot from the helicopter, it is left to rot on the ground. So that resource, that protein-rich food that could be feeding someone is left to waste.
I wonder what the biggest sort of cruelty or inhumane risks there are to deer with aerial control. Can you talk me through that?
If you were to harvest an unalert animal with you recreational hunting or even ground shooting through a program, that animal wouldn't be aware that you're there. They would be standing broadside and you'll be able to place a humane shot into its vitals and it would never know it was shot. Whereas if we apply the scenario where there's helicopters flying around, obviously that creates a disturbance amongst wildlife. That can start to drive behaviours where they move around, creating potential scenarios where there is a result in several shots being put into an animal, five or six, whereas previously in alternative situations, only one would be required. Animal welfare is a concern for everybody in society. And hunters, we take that particularly close to heart because when you're responsible for pulling that trigger, you want to ensure that you deliver a humane outcome for that animal at the other end.
What role do you see for hunters in managing feral deer populations?
There is a great opportunity to engage recreational hunters. Whilst at the moment there isn't the legislative ability for hunters to go and hunt on public land, and there are examples in New South Wales, Victoria and Tasmania where recreational hunters safely and routinely go out and harvest wild deer and consume that food after that on public land.
Australian Deer Association's Sean Kilkenny speaking to Pip Waller. DPIRT says aerial culling is carried out under strict animal welfare standards by trained professionals and is designed to control feral deer populations effectively. A priority for operators is to minimise stress to the animal and ensure mortality is achieved. And the RSPCA says it hasn't received any cruelty reports involving feral deer between July and August this year. It says it understands shots to the head are preferred as the animal is killed instantly compared to chest shots, which can cause more suffering. You can read more of this story online. Just search ABC Southwest and deer cull concerns. 7 minutes to one.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
Well, the Rams selling season has started here in WA and there's a sale currently underway in Esperance on the south coast. Tara de Landgraft is there. Tara, I hear some of the Rams sellers might be quite happy with some of the prices today.
Yeah, I think they would, Belle. As you can hear behind me, the sale is in full swing. Started just over an hour ago. 316 rams here that are on offer from six different studs. So there's 224 merinos and 92 white Suffolk. So the merinos are under the hammer first. The top price at the moment, $5,800. And there have been a couple of rams that have gone for over $5,000. So some pretty big prices indeed.
And were those sort of prices expected for today's sale?
Look, it's interesting. Having a chat with a few producers, we were talking about the fact that prices were pretty well supported last year as well, especially from a couple of studs who I suppose they have their regular customers year after year. So they have done pretty well over the last few years. I do think, though, that those prices, they'd be making some of those stud breeders smile, that's for sure. And I don't think it's out of the realms of possibility for the buyers down here to pay those prices either. So I think adding to that optimism in the industry, they're okay to pay that price if it keeps the sheep industry alive.
So you said there were a few smiles around. How would you describe the mood at the sale today?
Yeah, look, well, considering it's an absolutely beautiful day outside, blue skies, the crops will be growing, the pastures will be growing as well. There's a good crowd here. I think probably about 80 or so, probably even more. I'm sort of staying away from most so I don't accidentally put my hand up. Anybody who knows me knows I speak with my hands. I don't accidentally want to bring back a ram for the office. But look, lots of people smiling. They're, buying their rams, coming and getting something from the canteen, from the ladies who are doing a great job here, and heading back inside, catching up with people. It's been a pretty fortunate season for most farmers around the Esperance district, so plenty of smiles here, absolutely.
Okay, so real optimism about the future, yeah. Then.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of optimism, a lot of smiles, and I suppose those who have got out of sheep have got out, and those who are staying in, they're pretty keen to stay in and reap the high prices that are currently on offer.
And just give us that top price again. Well, the top price so far, Tara?
So far, $5,800.
That is great. Thank you so much for that, Tara. I'll let you get back to it.
Thanks, Belle.
Tara de Landgraaft, who's out at a ram sale in Esperance, underway, as you can hear in the background there on the south coast. 1:04 here on the Country Hour. Let's take a look at the wool market, which is up again this week. The Eastern Market Indicator up 30 cents to close at 1,291 cents a kilogram clean, and the Western Market Indicator up 22 cents to finish the week on 1,424 cents a kilo clean. Justin Haydock, another great week to be selling wool.
Yeah, we had a fantastic week again, Linda, 3 weeks in a row. So market has started the selling season absolutely firing. So all us wool brokers, we're a bit pumped at the moment there. EMI up 30 cents for the week. So that's had a good solid lift in US terms as well, trading at 842, up 24 cents in US terms. So that's about 60 cents in US terms since we started selling after the three-week break, July, August. The Aussie dollar was up to 65.22, up 0.36 of a cent. Total offering, 29,000 bales, 2.8% past in. I reckon that's probably the lowest I've seen it. 14.24 was the Western Market Indicator, up 22 cents. 17 microns have had a great lift. They traded most of last year below 1,700. They are now at 1,770. 18 microns, 1,666, up 31 cents. 19 microns, 1,570, up 25. 20 microns, 1,521, up 20 cents for the week, while 21 microns closed at 1,500. And they were up 20 cents. So 1,500 for a 21 micron, extremely good money. I think I've mentioned this a few times, but 1,500 does seem to be their resistance level. They seem to sit around there for a couple of weeks when they do reach that price, but it is not very common that they break through. So watch this space for a 21 micron.
All right. Well, let's have a look through who was buying this week. Can we start at the top and work down?
Righto, so Tech Wool Trading purchased 21.8% of the fleece nationwide. Endeavour Wool Exports, 12%. TNU Wool, 10.9%. PJ Morris, 10.8%. So tech full trading, obviously a lot of indent there. They're probably taking a little bit of a position on the market themselves, but purchased a lot of wool this week. They also purchased 22% of the skirtings. Crossbreds and Devil Wool Exports, 16.9%. Oddments, Michelle Wool, 17.7% of the oddments.
And then looking ahead to next week, what's going to be on offer?
Similar offering, so just under 29,000, 28,447, 5,000 to be sold in Fremantle. Will be a Tuesday sale in Fremantle and a one-day sale. So we're up about 1,500 bales in Frio on what we've sold this week. But look, this market's been great. This dollar's not doing a lot. It's hovering around the same level. But the good thing is we've seen a nice lift in US terms.
Thank you so much, Justin. The 1 o'clock news is next.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.